He unholstered a personal Flechette pistol, checked its charge of poisoned needles, and held his breath. A glow globe flickered over his head, dimmed, hypnotic. With a sound of running boots, one of his men reappeared, short of breath.
"Please come with me, my Lord Baron. You need to see this."
Unsettled, the man led the way down a short set of stairs and past a library where film books were still playing, their whispering voices droning into empty air, with no listeners. Cushion indentations remained on some of the chairs, where patrons had sat only moments ago. Everyone had disappeared without bothering to shut off the programs. The muffled speakers sounded like the voices of fading ghosts. The Baron's distress grew as he hobbled from room to room with the troopers, then finally from building to building. They found no one, not even when his men used primitive life tracer scanners.
Where were the witches?
In catacombs? Where had his escort Christine gone? Anger made the Baron's cheeks hot. How could he present his demands to the witch mother if he couldn't find her? Was Hrishka trying to buy time? By avoiding the confrontation, she had short-circuited his revenge. Did she think he would just go away? He hated to feel helpless. Swinging his walking stick, the Baron smashed the nearest library reader, then flailed about, breaking everything he could find. With glee, the guards set about overturning tables, knocking down shelves, tossing heavy volumes through glass windows. It accomplished nothing.
"Enough," he said,
then led the way down the corridor again. Presently he stood in a large office. Gold lettering on the door marked it as the workroom of the Mother Superior. The dark, highly polished desk was clear of objects. No files or records anywhere. Its chair sat at an angle, as if pushed back abruptly. On a ceramic dish, incense still burned, imparting a faint odor of cloves. He knocked it onto the floor in a flurry of aromatic ash.
"Damned witches!"
The Baron shivered. He and his men backed out of the room. Outside again, he became disoriented, a disconcertingly alien feeling of being lost. Neither he nor his guards could agree upon the correct route back to the shuttle. The Baron strode across an outdoor park and into a passageway that skirted a large stucco and timber building where lights burned inside. In the grand dining hall, hundreds of still steaming meals rested on long plank tables, benches arranged neatly in place. No other people were in the room.
No one.
With his finger, one of the troopers nudged a chunk of meat in a bowl of stew.
"Don't touch that," the Baron barked. "Could be subdermal poison."
It would be just the sort of thing the witches would try. The trooper recoiled. The squad leader's pale-eyed gaze darted around. His uniform was damp with perspiration.
"They must have been here only minutes ago. You can still smell the food."
The Baron cursed and swung his wormhead cane across the table, knocking plates, cups, and food to the floor. The clatter echoed off the walls and ceiling of the hall. But there was no other sound. His men used detection equipment to check under the floors, in the walls and ceilings, sweeping in all directions without success.
"Check the calibration on those life tracers. The witches are here somewhere, damn them!"
As he watched his men work feverishly, the Baron fumed. His skin crawled. He thought he heard a faint, smothered laugh, but it vanished into the haunted silence.
"Do you want us to torch this place, my Baron?" the squad leader asked,
eager for the conflagration. He imagined the entire mother school in flames, the convoluted wisdom and history and breeding records consumed in an inferno. Perhaps the black-clad witches would be trapped inside their hidden bolt holes and roasted alive. That would be worth seeing. But he shook his head, angry at the answer forced upon him. Until the witches gave him the cure he desperately needed, Baron Harkonnen dared not strike against the Bene Gesserit. Afterward, however, he would make up for lost time. There is no reality, only our own order imposed on everything. Basic Bene Gesserit dictum. For Jessica, it was like a child's game, except this one was deadly serious. Rustling like bats, hundreds of sisters filled the dining hall, amused to watch the Baron's antics, dodging him as if it were a game of invisible tag. Some crouched under tables. Jessica and Mohiam pressed against the wall. All the women were in silent breathing mode, concentrating on the illusion. No one spoke. They were in plain sight, but the befuddled Harkonnens could neither see nor sense them. The Baron saw only what the Bene Gesserit wanted him to see. On top of the head table stood the dark, aged Mother Superior, smiling like a schoolgirl in the middle of a prank. Arishka folded rail-thin arms across her chest as the pursuers grew more and more frustrated and noticeably agitated. A trooper passed only centimeters in front of Jessica. He waved a life tracer, nearly striking her face. But the guard saw nothing but false readings. On the dial of the scanner, data blinked and flared as the soldier moved past Jessica, though to him nothing registered on the gauge. Devices could not easily be fooled, but men were different. Life is an illusion to be tailored to our needs, she thought, quoting a lesson she had learned from her teacher, Mohiam. Every acolyte knew how to trick the eye, the most vulnerable of human senses. The sisters made barely audible sounds, dampened their slight movements. Knowing the swaggering Baron was on his way, Mother Superior had summoned the sisters into the great dining hall. "Baron Harkonnen believes he is in control," she had said in her crackling voice. "He thinks to intimidate us, but we must remove his strength, make him feel impotent. We are also buying time for ourselves to consider this matter, and giving the Baron time to make his own mistakes. Harkonnens are not known for their patience." Across the room, the clumsy Baron nearly brushed against Sister Christine, who slid smoothly away. "What the hell's was that?" He whirled, sensing the movement of air, a brief scent of fabric. "I heard something rustle, like a robe." The guards raised their weapons, but saw no targets. The heavyset man shuddered. Jessica exchanged a smile with her teacher. The Reverend Mother's normally flat eyes danced with glee. From her high table, Mother Superior stared down at the flustered men like a bird of prey. In preparation for the mass hypnosis that now smothered the Baron and his men, Sister Christine had allowed herself to be visible to them, so she could lead them into the web. But gradually the guide had faded from view as the sisters concentrated, focusing their efforts on these pliable victims. The Baron hobbled closer, his face a mask of unbridled fury. Jessica had the opportunity to trip him, but chose not to. Mohiam moved to glide beside him, said something faint and eerie. "You shall fear, Baron," in a directed whisper that carried only to the fat man's ears. This man she despised so much. Mohiam created a barely discernible susurration that twisted words from the litany against fear into something altogether different. "You shall fear. Fear is the mind killer. Fear is the little death that brings total obliteration." She walked around him, spoke to the back of his head. "You cannot face your fear. It will pass inside you and infect you." He thrashed with his hand, as if to bat away a bothersome insect. His expression looked troubled. "When we look upon the path of your fear,
There will be nothing left of you.
Smoothly, Mohiyam slipped away from him.
Only the sisterhood will remain.
The Baron stopped dead in his tracks, his face pale, his jowls twitching. His black eyes glanced to the left, where Mohiyam had been standing only seconds before. He swung his cane in that direction, so hard that he lost his balance and fell to the floor.
"Get me out of here!" he bellowed to his guards.
Two troopers rushed to help him to his feet. The squad leader guided them to the main doors and out into the passageway, while the remaining guards continued to search for targets, swinging the snub noses of their laser rifles back and forth. At the threshold, the Baron hesitated.
"Damned witches!"
he looked around.
"Which way back?"
"To the right, my Lord Baron," the squad leader said in a firm voice. Unknown to him, Christine hovered invisibly at his side, whispering directions in his ear. Upon reaching the shuttle, they would find it already set on automatic pilot, ready to take the Baron back through the planet's complex defenses to their frigate in orbit. Unsuccessful, frustrated, helpless, the Baron was not accustomed to such feelings.
"They wouldn't dare harm me," he muttered.
Nearby, several sisters snickered.
As the Harkonnens fled like gaze hounds with their tails between their legs, ghostly laughter from the dining hall followed them. Immobility is often mistaken for peace. Emperor Elrud Corino IX. With good humor, Romber's new concubine, Tesha, accompanied him around the grounds of Castle Caladan. It amused her that the exiled prince seemed more like an excited, clumsy child than the heir to a renegade house. It was a sunny morning, with lacy clouds drifting high overhead.
"It is hard to get to know you when you fawn upon me so, my prince."
They walked together along a terraced hillside path. He clearly felt out of his league.
First, you've got to call me Romber."
She raised her eyebrows, and her sepia eyes sparkled.
"I suppose that is a start."
He flushed deeply as they continued to walk.
"You must have smitten me, Tesha."
He plucked a field daisy from a spray of flowers on a grassy embankment and extended it to her.
"Since I'm the son of a great earl, I suppose I shouldn't allow that, should I?"
Tesha accepted the offering and spun the flower coyly in front of her plain but intelligent-looking face. She peeked around the petals at him. Her expression grew warm and understanding.
"There are some advantages to living in exile, I suppose. Nobody notices who you're smitten with."
Then she pointed a stern finger at him.
"Though I would respect you more if you did something to counteract the dishonor that's fallen on your family. Simply being an optimist hasn't achieved anything for years, has it? Trusting that everything will turn out right, thinking that you can do nothing more than sit here and complain? Talking is no substitute for doing."
Surprised by the remark, Romber spluttered his response.
"But I've, requested that Ambassador Pilru file petition after petition. Won't my oppressed people try to overthrow the invaders waiting for me to return? I expect to march back and reclaim my family name. Any time now."
"If you sit safely here and wait for your people to do your work for you, then you do not deserve to rule such a populace. Have you learned nothing from Leto Atreides?"
Tesha put her hands on her slender hips.
"If you ever intend to be an earl, Romber, you must follow your passions and get better intelligence reports."
He felt decidedly uncomfortable, stung by the truth in her words, but at a loss.
"How, Tesha? I have no army. Emperor Shaddam refuses to intervene, and the Landsraad, too. I was only granted limited amnesty when my family went renegade. What else can I do?
Determined, she grasped his elbow as they continued their brisk walk.
If you permit me, perhaps I might make suggestions. They teach us many subjects on Wallach 9, including politics, psychology, strategy, facilitation. Never forget that I am a Bene Gesserit, not a serving wench. I am intelligent and well-educated, and I see many things that you do not.
Romber stumbled along with her, trying to regain his mental balance.
Suspicious, he said. Is this something the sisterhood put you up to? Were you assigned as my concubine just to help me get Ix back?
No, my prince.
I won't pretend, though, that the Bene Gesserit wouldn't prefer to have a stable House Vernius back in power. Dealing with the Bene Tlelax is far more difficult and confusing.
Tessia ran her fingers through her close-cropped brown hair, making it look as mussed as the prince's perpetual tangles.
For myself, I would rather be the concubine of a great earl within the fabled Grand Palais on Ix than of an exiled prince who lives off the good graces of a generous duke.
He swallowed hard, then plucked another field daisy and sniffed at himself.
I would rather be that person too, Tessia.
Looking down from a castle balcony, Leto watched Romber and Tessia stroll hand in hand across a field of wildflowers swaying in the ocean breeze. Leto felt a heavy ache in his heart, a warm envy toward his friend. The Ixian prince seemed to be walking on air, as if he had forgotten all about the troubles on his overthrown homeworld. He smelled Kylea's perfume behind him, a sweet, flowery scent reminiscent of hyacinth and lily of the valley. But he hadn't heard her approach. He looked back at her, and wondered how long she had been standing there, watching him stare down at the inseparable lovers.
"She's good for him," Kylea said. "I never had much fondness for the Bene Gesserit before this, but Tessia is an exception."
Leto chuckled. "He does seem quite taken with her. A testament to sisterhood seduction training."
Kylea cocked her head. She wore a jewel-studded comb in her hair, and had taken particular care to apply the most flattering touch of makeup. He had always found her beautiful, but at this moment she seemed aglow. "It takes more than dueling practice, parades, and fishing trips to make my brother happy. Or any man."
Kylea stepped out onto the sunlit balcony with Leto, and he became uncomfortably aware of how alone they were. Back before the fall of Ix, when she had been the daughter of a powerful great house, Kylea Vernius had seemed a perfect match for Leto. Given time in the normal course of events, old Duke Paulus and Earl Dominic Vernius probably would have arranged a marriage. But things were much different now. He could not afford to become entangled with a young woman from a renegade house, a person who, in theory, carried a death sentence if she ever tried to become involved in imperial politics. As a noble daughter, Kylea could never become just a casual lover, like a girl from the village below Castle Caladan. But he couldn't deny his feelings. And wasn't a duke entitled to take a concubine if he wished? There was no shame in it for Kylea either, especially with her lack of prospects.
"Well, Leto, what are you waiting for?"
She stepped close to him, so that one of her breasts grazed his arm. Her perfume made him dizzy with pheromones.
"You are the duke. You can have anything you desire."
Kylea drew out the last word. "And what makes you think there's anything I desire?" To his own ears, his voice sounded strangely hollow. Raising her eyebrows, she gave him a coy smile.
"Surely you are accustomed to making difficult decisions by now?"
He hesitated, frozen. "Indeed," he thought. "What am I waiting for?"
They both moved at the same time, and he took her warmly into his arms with a long-held sigh of relief and growing passion. From the time Leto was young, he remembered watching his father spend sunny days in the courtyard of Castle Caladan, where he would listen to the petitions, concerns, and well-wishes of the people. Old Pollis's bearish, bearded father had called it going about the business of being a duke. Leto carried on the tradition. A line of people trudged up the steep path to the open gates to participate in an archaic system in which the duke settled disputes. Though efficient legal systems existed in all the large cities, Leto did this for the opportunity to maintain contact with his people. He liked to respond personally to their complaints and suggestions. He found it better than any number of surveys, opinion polls, and reports from supposed experts. As he sat under the warm morning sun, he listened to one person after another as the line shuffled forward. An old woman, whose husband had gone to sea in a storm and never returned, asked that he be declared dead, and went on to request Leto's blessing and dispensation to marry her husband's brother. The young duke told her to wait a month on both accounts, after which he would approve her petition. A 10-year-old boy wanted to show Leto a seahawk he had raised from the time it was a chick. The large red-crested bird clutched the boy's leather-cuffed wrist, then flew up into the open air of the courtyard, circled, much to the terror of the sparrows nesting in the eaves, and came back to the boy when he whistled. Leto loved to focus his attentions on personal details here at home, where he could actually see how his decisions mattered to the lives of his people. The immense Imperium, supposedly spanning a million worlds, seemed too abstract, too vast to matter much here. Still, the bloody conflicts on other worlds, such as between Ekaz and Grumman, or the ages-old animosity between House Atreides and House Harkonnen, affected their own populations in as personal a way as anything he saw here. Leto had long been eligible for marriage. Very eligible, in fact. And other Landsrad members wanted to enter into an alliance with House Atreides and mingle bloodlines. Would it be one of the daughters of Armand Ekaz? Or would some other family make him a better offer? He had to play the dynastic game his father had taught him. For years now he'd longed for Caelia Vernius, but her family had fallen, her house gone renegade. A duke of House Atreides could never marry such a woman. It would be political suicide. Still, that did not make Caelia any less beautiful or desirable. Romber, happy with Tesha, had suggested that Leto take Caelia as his ducal concubine. For Caelia, there would certainly be no shame in becoming the chosen lover of a duke. In fact, it would secure her precarious position here on Caladan, where she lived under a provisional amnesty, with no guarantees. Next, a balding man with squinting eyes opened a smelly basket. A pair of house guards closed in on him, but moved back when he lifted out a warm, reeking fish that must have been dead for days. Flies buzzed around it. When Leto frowned, wondering what insult this could be, the fisherman blanched, suddenly realizing the impression he had made.
"Oh, no, no, my lord duke. This ain't an offering. No, look ye. This fish has sores. All my catch in the southern sea had sores."
Indeed, the belly of the fish was rough and leprous.
"The sea kelp rafts out there are dying, and they stink to the heavens. Something's wrong, and I thought ye should know about it."
Leto looked over at Thufir Hawat, calling on the old warrior to use his mentat skills.
"A plankton bloom, Thufir?"
Hawat scowled, his mind racing, and then he nodded.
"Likely killed off the seaweed, which is now rotting, spreading disease among the fish."
Leto looked at the fisherman, who hurriedly covered his basket and held it behind his back to keep the smell far away from the duke's chair.
Thank you, sir, for bringing this to our attention. We'll have to burn the dead kelp islands. Maybe add some nutrients to the water to restore a proper plankton and algae balance.
Sorry about the stink, my Lord Duke.
The fisherman fidgeted. One of Leto's guards took the basket and, holding it at arm's length, carried it outside the gates, where the sea breezes would absorb the odor. Without you, I might not have learned about the problem for weeks. You have our gratitude. Despite Caladan's excellent satellites and weather stations, Leto often learned information, more accurately and swiftly, through the people rather than these mechanisms. The next woman wanted to give him her prized chicken. Then two men were disputing the boundaries of Pundi rice fields and dickering over the value of an orchard lost by flood when a crumbling dike spilled water into the lowlands. An old lady presented Leto with a thick sweater she had knitted herself. Next, a proud father wanted Leto to touch the forehead of his newborn daughter. The business of being a duke. Tesha eavesdropped outside the sitting area of the castle apartment she shared with Romber, while Leto and the prince discussed imperial politics. The embarrassing vandalism of Carino monuments, the declining health of Baron Harkonnen, the escalating and unpleasant conflict between Mauritani and Ekaz, even with Sardaukar peacekeeping troops in place on Grumman, and the continued efforts of Leto's diplomatic corps to interject a note of reason to the situation. The conversation eventually turned to the tragedies that had befallen House Vernius. How long it had been since the overthrow of Ix. Expressing resentment for this had become routine for Romber, though he never found the courage to take the next step toward reclaiming his birthright. Safe and content on Caladan, he had given up hoping for revenge, or at least had put it off for another undetermined day. By now, Tesha had had enough. While still at the mother school, she'd read thick files on House Vernius. Her knowledge of the history and politics of technology was a common interest with Romber. Even knowing all the sisterhood's plans within plans, she felt as if she'd been made for him, and therefore obligated to nudge him into action. She hated to see him stuck. Wearing a floor-length black and yellow calico dress, Tesha placed a silver tray with flagons of dark beer on the table between the men. She spoke up, surprising them with her interruption. "I've already promised you my help, Romber. Unless you intend to do something about the injustice to your house, don't complain about it for another decade." Raising her chin arrogantly, Tesha spun about. "I, for one, don't want to hear it." Leto saw the flash in her intense, wide-set eyes. In astonishment, he watched her leave the room with only a faint rustle of her dress. "Well, Romber, I expected a Bene Gesserit to be more circumspect. Is she always so blunt?" Romber looked stunned. He picked up his beer and swallowed a gulp. How in only a few weeks did Tesha figure out exactly what I needed to hear? A fire burned in his eyes, as if the concubine had merely provided the spark for the tinder that had been piling up inside him for so long. "Maybe you've been too kind all these years, Leto, making me overly comfortable while my father stays in hiding, while my people remain enslaved." He blinked. "It's not going to turn out for the best all by itself, is it?" Leto stared at him for a long moment. "No, my friend. No, it isn't." Romber could not ask Leto to send massive forces on his behalf, because that would invite open warfare between House Atreides and the Bene Tlelax. Leto had already risked everything to prevent that from happening. Right now he was just a piece of flotsam, without a purpose. The prince's face darkened with determination. "Maybe I ought to make a grand gesture, return to my home world, take a formal diplomatic frigate with a full escort. I could rent one, I suppose, and land in the port of Entry Canyon on Ix. I'd publicly reclaim my name, demand that the Tlelaxu renounce their illegal seizure of our planet." He huffed. "What do you think they'd say to that?" Don't be foolish, Romber. Leto shook his head, wondering if his friend was serious or not. They'd take you prisoner and perform medical experiments on your body. You'd end up in a dozen pieces and a dozen different axolotl tanks. Vermilion hells, Leto. What else am I going to do? Distracted and disturbed, the prince stood up.
If you will excuse me, I need to think.
He trudged up a low riser to his private bedchamber and shut the door. Leto stared after his friend for a long moment, sipping his drink, before returning to his private study and the piled inventory documents awaiting his inspection and signature. Watching from an upstairs balcony, Tesha flitted down the winding stairs and slid open the bedroom door. Inside, she found Romber on the bed, staring at a picture of his parents on the wall. Kylea had painted it herself, longing for the days in the Grand Palais. In the picture, Dominic and Shando Vernius were dressed in full regalia, the bald earl in a white uniform with purple and copper Ixion helixes adorning the collar, and she in a billowing lavender myrrh silk gown. Tesha massaged his shoulders.
It was wrong of me to embarrass you in front of the Duke. I'm sorry.
He saw the tenderness and compassion in her sepia gaze. Why apologize? You're right, Tesha, though it's difficult for me to admit it. Maybe I'm ashamed. I should have done something to avenge my parents.
To avenge all of your people.
And to free them. She heaved an exasperated sigh.
Romber, my true prince, do you want to be passive, defeated, and complacent, or triumphant? I'm trying to help you.
Romber felt her surprisingly strong hands working expertly at his knotted muscles, loosening them, warming them. Her touch was like a soothing drug, and he was tempted to sleep so that he could forget his troubles. He shook his head.
I gave up without a fight, didn't I?
The concubine's fingers worked down his spine to the small of his back, arousing him.
That doesn't mean you can't fight again.
With a deeply puzzled expression, Kylea Vernius brought a shiny black packet to her brother.
It has our family crest on it, Romber. Just came from a courier in Kala City.
His sister had green eyes and copper-dark hair held back by glazed shell combs. Her face had grown into the lush beauty of womanhood with the soft edges of youth. She reminded Romber of their mother Shando, who had once been a concubine of Emperor Elrud's. Perplexed, the prince gazed at the helix on the package, but saw no other markings. Dressed in common, comfortable clothes, Tesha came up behind Romber while he used a small fishing knife to cut open the parcel. His brow wrinkled as he brought out a sheet of Redulian paper with lines, triangles, and dots on it. Then he caught his breath.
It looks like a sub rosa message, an Ixion battle code written in a geometrical cipher.
Kylea pursed her lips.
Father taught me the complexities of business, but little of military matters. I didn't think I needed them.
Can you decode it, my prince?
Tesha asked in a voice that made Romber wonder if his Bene Gesserit concubine also had special translation skills. He scratched his tousled blonde hair, then reached for a notepad.
Let me see. My tutor used to beat the codes into my head, but it's been years since I've thought about them.
Romber sat cross-legged on the floor, then began scribbling the Gallic alphabet in a scrambled order he'd memorized. He scratched out lines and recopied the pattern more carefully. With old memories coming back to him, he stared at the paper and his pulse quickened. Someone with inside knowledge had undoubtedly prepared this. But who? Next, Romber took a ruler and, measuring carefully, made a new sheet into a grid. Across the top, he wrote the scrambled alphabet. One letter inside each square. then added a pattern of coding dots. Placing the mysterious message next to his decryption sheet, he lined up dots with letters, then transcribed one word at a time.
Vermilion hells!
Prince Romber Vernius, rightful Earl of Ix. The Tleilaxu usurpers torture or execute our people for perceived infractions, then use the corpses for horrible experiments. Our young women are stolen in the darkness. Our industries remain overrun by invaders. There is no justice for Ix, only memories, hopes, and slavery. We long for the day when House Vernius can crush the invaders and once again free us. With all due respect, we request your assistance. Please help us. The note was signed by Kater Pilru of the Freedom Fighters of Ix. Romber leaped to his feet and hugged his sister.
It's the ambassador's son. Kylea, do you remember?
Eyes lit with half-forgotten happiness, she remembered how the dark-haired twins had flirted with her.
Nice-looking young man. His brother became a guild navigator, didn't he?
Romber grew silent. For years he'd known such things were happening on his world, but he'd avoided thinking about it, hoping the problems would go away. How could he contact the rebels on Ix? As an exiled prince without a house, how could he address the tragedy? He hadn't been willing to consider all the possibilities.
Mark my words, Romber vowed. I'm going to do something about this. My people have waited too long.
He pulled back from his sister, and his gaze moved around to Tessia, who stood watching him.
I'd like to help, she said. You know that.
Romber drew his concubine and his sister to him in a great bear hug. Finally, he had a sense of purpose. To learn about this universe, one must embark on a course of discovery where real dangers exist. Education cannot impart this discovery. It is not a thing to be taught and used or put away. It has no goals. In our universe, we consider goals to be end products, and they are deadly if one becomes fixated on them. Friedrich Ginaz, Philosophy of the Swordmaster. Transport ornithopters carried the Ginaz students in groups, descending as they flew along the edge of a forbidding new island, beside black lava cliffs worn slick over the centuries by cascading waterfalls. The mound of sharp rock rose out of the water like a rotten tooth, without jungles, without greenery, without apparent habitation. Surrounded by deep, treacherous water, the mountainous island, nameless except for its military designation, lay at the eastern end of the archipelago.
Ah, look, another tropical paradise, he Resser said, in a dry tone.
Peering through one of the small portholes, crowded beside his classmates, Duncan Idaho knew this place would only hold new ordeals for all of them. But he was ready. The Fopter gained altitude and flew up the windward side to the curving mouth of a steep crater. Smoke and ash still coughed out of vents, adding a heavy, hot pall to the humid air. The pilot circled around so they all could identify a single shining Fopter landed on the crater rim. The small craft would be used in some part of their training, no doubt. Duncan could not guess what might be in store for them. The Fopter cruised to the base of the volcano, where jutting elbows of cracked reefs and steaming fumaroles formed their camp. Colorful, self-erecting tents dotted flat surfaces of the lava rock, encircling a larger compound. No amenities whatsoever. When they landed, many of the students rushed out to choose their tents, but Duncan could not see how any one was preferable to another. The tall swordmaster waiting for them had leathery skin, a mane of thick gray hair that hung to the middle of his back, and haunting eyes set deeply into bony sockets. With a twinge of awe, Duncan recognized the legendary warrior,
Mord Kor.
As a child on Hagal, Kor had been the sole survivor of his massacred mining village. He'd lived as a feral boy in the forested cliffs, taught himself to fight, then infiltrated the bandit gang that had destroyed his village. After gaining their trust, he single-handedly slew the leader and all the bandits, then marched off to join the Emperor's Sardaukar. He had served as Elrud's personal swordmaster for years before retiring to the academy on Ginaz. After making them recite the swordmaster's pledge in unison, the legendary warrior said,
"I have killed more people than any of you pups have ever met. Pray that you do not become one of them. If you learn from me, then I will have no excuse to slay you."
"I don't need any incentive to learn from him," Resser said to Duncan out of the corner of his mouth. The old man heard the muttered words and snapped his glance over to the red-headed student. In the back of the group, Trin Kronos, one of the other Grumman trainees, though much less friendly, snickered, then silenced himself. As Mord Kor held Resser with his piercing gaze, waiting, Duncan cleared his throat and took one step forward. "Swordmaster Kor, he said that none of us needs an incentive to learn from a great man like you, sir." He gripped the hilt of the old Duke's sword.
"No one requires an excuse to learn from a great man."
Kor swiveled around to look at all the students.
"You know why you are here? Here, on Ginaz, I mean?"
"Because this is where Jul Noret started everything," the dark-skinned trainee from Aldanab said promptly.
"Jul Noret didn't do anything," Kor said, shocking them all. "He was a tremendous swordmaster, skilled in 93 fighting methods. He knew about weapons, shields, tactics, and hand-to-hand combat. A dozen other skilled fighters followed him like disciples, begging Noret to teach them advanced skills. But the great fighter always refused, always put it off with the promise he would train them when the time was right. And he never did. One night a meteor struck the ocean offshore and sent a wave crashing into the island where Jul Noret lived. The water flattened his hut and killed him in his sleep. It was all his followers could do to recover his body. That mummified relic they'll be proud to show you back on the administration island."
"But, sir, if Jul Noret taught nothing, why was the Ginaz school founded in his name?" Resser said.
"Because his disciples vowed not to make the same mistake. Remembering all the skills they'd wanted to learn from Noret, they formed an academy where they could teach the best candidates all the fighting techniques they might require."
The ash-choked breezes ruffled his hair.
"So, are you all ready to learn how to become swordmasters?"
The students answered with a resounding, "Yes!" Kor shook his long gray mane and smiled. The gusts of ocean wind sounded like sharp fingernails scraping the lava cliffs.
"Good. We will begin with 2 weeks of studying poetry."
In the minimal shelter of their colorful tents, the trainees slept on the rocks, cold during the night, baking hot during the day.